Welcome. I am Zitulele Christopher Mzaneli, and our topic for discussion this morning is entitled The Church in a Divided Society, Towards a South African Black Liberation Theology. Yesterday, somehow we tried to give you what I call a bird's eye view of what probably is substantive in the African milieu, what in the African milieu can be appropriated into our own understanding of Christianity. I will not then burden you by that history this morning. I'd like to move on to begin to make some introductory remarks with respect to the way I understand theology. For me, I believe that there is only one theology, and that is, if we think of theology in capital letters, the varieties that may cause us to wonder about these variations, for me, represent perspectives in theology rather than theologies. So that the variations then are varieties in perspective rather than anything else. Maybe then the big question is that what is theology then? I understand theology to be thinking intelligently about my faith. Thinking intelligently about my faith. The project of black theology or liberation theology in general is not a new subject. I'm sure that most of you have been exposed into some form of liberation theology, be it the Latin American expression of liberation theology or the American expression of liberation theology, which expresses itself through what is called black theology. For me then, both the Latin American expression of liberation theology and the black theology project represent those kinds of variations in perspective rather than substantive differences. Given then those kinds of barometers, I think it is possible for us then to move into looking at some of the contributions of what I call African Christianity. But I do not want to pretend that Africans are agreed in terms of what this African Christianity should be. I'll give you a little example. In South Africa today, there's a lot of debate between African Christianity as it is expressed in independent Africa today and the black theology expression as it is manifest in South Africa. The two, for most black South Africans, are polarized. For example, I'll just mention two African scholars from the Republic of South Africa. The first is Bishop Manus Buthelezi, a Lutheran, Bishop of the Central Diocese in Johannesburg. Manus Buthelezi did his graduate work at Yale Divinity School, where he got a Master of Sacred Studies degree. And then he moved on to Drew University, where he finished his PhD there in systematic theology. Manners holds that the Africans to the north of the Republic of South Africa have more been preoccupied with what he terms worldview types of African incentives, rather than to try and appropriate that milieu in the here and now. He feels like what Pastor Will Hersfeld, for example, said yesterday, that what I was saying about the African ethos seems to be, or looks, or appears to be looking backwards, appropriating and focused towards the past of the African experience. And that, for him, for example, is where the point of diversity existed between our dialogue yesterday. I think Manas Buthelezi, for example, shares that. And I'd like for a moment to take that very seriously, because I think there is a point in holding that somehow the preoccupations about the African worldview tend to look backwards. Another black theologian from South Africa, who has also written quite a bit, and his essays have appeared, for example, in the documentary History of Black Theology that has been edited by William Gilmore and James Cone, is Bishop Tutu. Bishop Tutu is an Anglican, and is currently the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches. Bishop Tutu did his graduate studies at the University of London, where he earned a Bachelor of Divinity degree. He feels, like Manas, that the problem of African theology generally is that it focuses too much on the African world view as an entity in itself, and feels that rather the mode, both Tutu and Manas feel that the interpretive mode that the understanding of the African symbols should take is what is currently known in cultural anthropology in America as the interpretive mode. And what that does, for example, if you think of people like Clifford Gittes, for example, Gitts, the interpretive mode of understanding symbols is to describe them and see how they inform the here and now, rather than to hold them as something of the past and try to literally understand them in the past. Because if you do that, then the problem is that you short circuit them and circumvent their force by epitomizing them in the worldview experience. Since, as we all know, worldviews are what separates cultures. So that then if you focus merely on worldview, then you end up with a view that is half authenticated, to the extent that it remains polarized to the cultural incentive that we know in the modern world, and especially in the secular cult. Given then those kinds of constraints, how do I see the bridging of the gaps between African theology on the one hand and black theology on the other? My own sense is that it is not a question of either or, but rather a question of both and. How do we arrive then at that kind of synthesis. In order for us to be able to understand and substantiate that, we need to backtrack just a little bit and begin to focus and take the two milieus, or understanding of theology separately. I'd like to begin with some kind of what I think is substantive in the African ethos. And when I do that, I like to do it under the auspices of what I call the Black Consciousness Movement of South Africa as a revitalization movement. There's a big question then that what is revitalization? And at that point, I borrowed the concept of revitalization from Anthony Wallace. Anthony Wallace defines culture or cultural symbols as follows. He speaks of a revitalization process. The revitalization is a cultural renewal process. It can be seen as a form of change, which calls for a restatement of what in a culture is worth keeping or completely destroying. The level of change must be large enough to call for fundamental change. Wallace notes that the revitalization movements are not unusual phenomena, but are recurrent features of human history. The significance then of Wallace's finding is that he says in a given culture, the symbols of a given culture have an inner dynamism in and of themselves. So that what happens in a cultural revitalization is a kind of reformation, or rather even to use a less loaded term, is a kind of renaissance of the symbols of that given culture, wherein people begin to look at this is our worldview, this is our culture, these are our symbols. What then can we do in order to enact and appropriate those symbols for the here and now? And then he speaks at that point of, quote unquote, the revitalization process. The South African Black Consciousness Movement, to me, represents that kind of incentive. Let us for a moment define what we mean by the Black Consciousness Movement. The Black Consciousness Movement as a revitalization movement, I'll read that again. The Black Consciousness Movement was a revitalization movement in that it sought to define and appropriate the African ethos and see how this ethos informed their understanding of the Christian ethos and how this appropriation could inform their struggle for liberation. That is what, in essence, marks and epitomizes what is distinctive with the Black Consciousness Movement of South Africa. The big problem then is, how do we move then to appropriate this African ethos? What kind of methods are pertainable for us to begin to do exactly what we stood made ourselves to do in terms of revitalizing our own symbols? There are just two methodological things that I think are important in terms of how we tried to appropriate the African ethos and see how it informs the Christian ethos for us within the Black Consciousness Movement. That methodological tool for me is well enunciated by Paulo Freire as understanding of education. Paulo Freire distinguishes two types of education. He speaks of what he calls the banking theory of education, by which he means looking at the content of what is disseminated in the educational process as something that is neutral, something that is not culture-bound. It's just a dissemination of neutral facts that can be transposed from the educator to the one that is educated, or the listener in that instant, with no cultural biases. He holds that that's a falsified premise for education, that that kind of theory of education is false. He then juxtaposes what he calls libertarian education. And I think because it's so central in our enterprise, I will just give you a direct quote from what he has written in The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I quote, "Libertarian education takes off from the resolution of the teacher-student contradiction by reconciling the actors on the educational forum so that both are simultaneously teachers and students. True education cannot be prescribed, nor is it a gift from the oppressor. It comes by conquest." What is then distinctive with this method of understanding the educational process or enterprise is that the former, or the understanding of education as a banking theory, takes off from the assumption that education is an objective enterprise par excellence. You can objectively understand these facts and therefore be able to disseminate them out there. He says that is false, because education, by definition, is experiential. And perhaps that is where, for me, this understanding of education becomes very significant. Because I understand the theological enterprise, or at least our understanding of faith, or even thinking about our faith intelligently, is always an experiential enterprise. That is where this kind of method of understanding education becomes a methodological tool for me, whereby I can move from my milieu to understand what the Christian ethos is all about, because I cannot be a Christian objectively, but rather I am a Christian by experience. Having done that, then I think we are ready to begin to move into seeing what is substantive in the African milieu. And I just want to take two points of reference that I think epitomizes what is substantive in the African understanding of symbols. And that, first of all, relates to the African understanding of personality. What is distinctive, then, with the African understanding of personality? Benjamin Ray depicts what is unique in the African understanding of a personality as follows, and I quote, "The African views of man strike a balance between his collective identity as a member of society and his personal identity as a unique individual. In general, African philosophy tends to define persons in terms of social groups to which they belong. A person is thought first of all as a constituent of a particular community." I repeat, particular community. "For it is the community which defines who he is and who he can become. But the African thought also recognizes that each individual is a unique person, endowed by the Creator with his own personality and talents, and motivated by his own particular needs and ambitions," unquote. That then, in essence, is what is distinctive in the African understanding of personality. In other words, a person is seen as part of a community. And in doing so, it is also recognized that he is not just a conglomerate, he is also a person, a distinct individual. So that what is distinctive then is trying to strike a delicate balance between those two poles. How then is that balance arrived at? This balance is further articulated by Professor Mazisi Kunene, who teaches at UCLA as follows, and I quote, "Africa has a different social strategy with which it describes its social relations. Praise does not mean the same type of individual glorification as is the case with the idealized hero of individualistic societies, which is both inherent and immutable. In the African epic, the story, the hero's actions are made directly relevant to the story. The hero's actions are made directly relevant to society's welfare. The hero is not depicted as superhuman, but as an ordinary being whose feats approximate the social ideal. These different factors warrant a re-examination of what constitutes a hero in communal-oriented societies. Common to both is the intent to define heroic actions on an epic scale." The comparison ends at this point. The African epic demands of his hero a flexible set of qualities that can be evaluated in accordance with the mores of society. Heroism deserves the social acclaim because it is the fate of the whole society," unquote. Now, this is how this epitomizes how this delicate balance is arrived at. In other words, the individual is always made accountable to his communal context. It is a determinative factor, and this is, for obvious reasons, very different from the Western understanding of personality, where, you know, individualism becomes the primary motif. I'd like then to move to the second substantive point in what I describe as distinctive in the African understanding of religion. And here we have 2 points, and then after this we will stop and or we'll make one more observation and then open up for discussion after these 2 points. The African understanding of religion, especially as represented among the Zulus, focuses on 2 points. The first is the idea of balance as a religious ethos, which we have just reiterated in Mazisi's enunciation of the idea of balance, using the epic poetry or the understanding of the hero as a religious symbol. Amongst the Zulu, or within the Zulu ethos, the idea of balance is arrived at trying to mitigate the poles of the positive forces in the human condition on the one hand and the negative forces on the other. The Zulu see life as a constant battle between those forces of life that seek to annihilate them and those life forces that reaffirm life. In other words, within the Zulu ethos, the human condition is inherently seen with these two poles, the positive forces on the one hand and the negative forces on the other. This is a quote from my own thesis that I did at the Graduate Theological Union in 1979 for my MA. The second then important thing in this balance is that they see social reality as inherently sacred. The central teaching among Bantu is that all things originate from Ukobo and evolve in response to the challenge of their nature, that the person is a self-defined value, and that life's purpose for the person is perpetually evolving. The person, however, cannot exist of himself, by himself or herself. He or she comes from a social structure. He or she exists in a social cluster and dies physically in order to live in community of the spirit. In the community of spirits, spirit forms called amadlos. This is a quote from Jordan Gubane in the book entitled Conflicts of Mind, pages 77 through 78. Again here, we see the importance of religion, the importance of the sacred. If these then are what is distinctive with the African ethos, how then do we bridge the polarity between African religion? If African theology north of the Republic of South Africa has made an issue of these two substantive things that I've been talking about, how then could we bridge them with the contradiction which both Bishop Manas Buthelezi and Bishop Turo feel? My own way of integrating these two polarized positions comes from one of my professors at graduate school, Professor Albert Roberto. He has written the book Slave Religion. In Slave Religion, Roberto argues and tries to say what was distinctive with the slave experience. And not just distinctive, what is it that now manifests itself in the black churches which they have inherited from the slave experience? Therefore, the title, Slave Religion, for the book.
Juxtaposed to that, in the book Slave Religion, is Fraser's argument. And Fraser argues that because of the decarceralization process, there is nothing that black Americans brought from Africa. In other words, the decarceralization process for Fraser was final, it was just an end. So that what is distinctive in the black religion in America is something that comes out of, you know, they are borrowing from things that have learned in the Caribbean, and bits and pieces of syncretistic tendencies that, say, for example, cargo cults in New York and New Orleans might have brought in, but those kinds of incentives either came with free blacks or alternatively with people from the Caribbean. But if you talk of the black religious experience in America, there is nothing distinctively African from that, argues Fraser. Raboteau takes seriously the argument of Fraser and says that, you know, Fraser is right to the extent that Fraser was arguing against the people in America who wanted to repatriate the Negroes of the United States. So that given that kind of constraint, Fraser is right to be polemic against the repatriation syndrome, and therefore overreacts and negativizes his own experience in order to circumvent some of those polarities. He then mitigates between the two opposing views by saying that it is not a question of either or, but rather both and. That if we can speak of anything distinctive in what he calls slave religion, it is distinctive to the extent that it appropriates in its entirety the authentic African ethos. And then he pulls and says, for example, the good example, how, for example, Fraser was really biased and reactionary to the forces of the American social economic or ulterior motives of having to repatriate the repatriate blacks. He says that then Fraser was reacting to the extent that, I mean, this is shown by Alex Haley's Roots phenomenon, for example, that would not have been possible if indeed the culturalization was that distinctive, or if it was the final point. In using those kinds of incentive, I find that it is possible to mitigate between the African ethos on the one hand and the black theology experience in South Africa on the other. Because I feel personally that both Bishop Tutu and Manus Buthelezi are reacting because of the use or the overtness and the fact that, you know, the African ethos in South Africa is what the apartheid state has utilized in order to show that we are distinctive. In order to divide and rule, they have held that Zulus cannot mix with Xhosas, Zulus cannot mix with Sotus, and therefore, when they see how this culture is manipulated by the powers that be, they commit the same error that Fraser committed. That because of those kinds of constraints, necessarily we must reject the African worldview as it is represented in what I've already enunciated as distinctive between the African understanding of personality and the African understanding of religion. For those reasons alone, they feel we should not indulge in those kinds of worldview incentives. For if anything, they tend to paralyze the Zulu against the Xhosa and the Sotho. For the same reason, then, I feel that that kind of argument is more reductionist, is what I call African reductionism. I feel they are being persuaded by secular incentives that use, as essential phenomenology to appropriate the view. It seems to me that that is an imposition on an authentic understanding of the African milieu as represented, for example, by Africans to the north of the Republic of South Africa. And more importantly, as represented by the kind of experience that I reiterated to you yesterday, that we have those contradictions in our churches today, that people still are very African. Either we are going to deny that or excommunicate, 50% of our parishioners, or we have to find some way of saying that this is not a question of either or, but rather, more importantly, a question of both and. I have just thrown in a lot of facts here, so then I'd like to give you time to begin to interact, and so that we can begin to knit together some of the probably discrepancies that may have arisen in our discussion. We are open to questions.
If I understand you then rightly, Chris, and I'm not sure that I do, but in this process of re-tribalization, that to take what is inherently native in the South African ethos, as you speak of it, that to bring into that Christianity, which involves a re-tribalization, mm-hmm. is going to be an exceedingly difficult process then, if I hear you correctly.
I would say yes and no. I would say yes, to the extent that perhaps, there are polarities as long as we understand Christianity in the Western idiom. That would be true, because the two are polarized. But in its essence, especially within Lutheran circles, I think there is a lot going for the authentic African expression, which is manifested in what I call the law-gospel dialectic. What the Zulu, for example, have described within the human condition as the polarities between the negative and the positive forces of the human condition can be interpreted and appropriated sufficiently using the Lutheran categories of law and gospel. In fact, I would even go a step further and say that it's not just Lutheran parochialism, but it is also can be appropriated within the law gospel dialectic as it is epitomized in Protestant faith. So that using those, for example, I can really appropriate without any qualms the polarities between the understanding of the negative forces and the positive forces in the human condition. Does this answer your question?
Yeah. And well, that leads to another one, but I don't want to use first. Others have questions. I'll ask mine later.
You just have to do that because I think somehow in those in so-called independent churches is something that is very authentic that needs to be appropriated and looked into seriously rather than dismissed offhand as something that is belongs to the past and relegated to the polarities of a worldview or at the ethnographic approach to the anthropological enterprise.
Yeah, I'll ask my. What seems to me, listening in back of what you say, is the distinct promise of disassociating yourself from the Christianity of the South African, the white South African there, that as they practice it with the limits that you've spoken about the last couple of years. A couple of days, rather. It's to disassociate yourself from that kind of Christianity that segregates, that comes with a kind of laws to we spoke of it yesterday. In other words, to see Christianity as you have espoused it, in concert at all with the Christianity practiced by the white population of South Africa, it seems to me that is a tremendous handicap to overcome, isn't it?
I'm not sure I understand you.
Well, in other words, the South African, the white population of South Africa, now the Union of South Africa, and which, as I understand it, are largely Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be Lutheran, but at least they're Christian.
Okay.
They practice Christianity.
Okay.
In other words, that here you come with Christianity as you try to take it and into the retribalization process. In other words,
why don't you define for me what you mean by retribalization? Because maybe that's where our problem.
Well, I'm not really sure. That here is an integration of Christianity with the existing symbols,
mm-hmm,
of the black experience, of black ethos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that involves a translation, I think, in many ways, isn't it? For instance, what is integral to the Christian faith that is going to become part and parcel of the new black experience?
That's a tough one. I think in order to react to this, I think there are two things that I need to do. First is my own understanding of, I hate the term tribalization, because of obvious biases that are inherent in that kind of question, first of all, so that I prefer then the word ethos. And the reason I do that is that for me, in my ministry and in fact, in my studies, I have learned that simply to hope, and this again, I would remind you of what we were discussing yesterday here with Brother Will, that arises, the whole thing of discarding the African ethos can only be an authentic expression if you really believe in the melting pot syndrome, which sociologists have enunciated beyond doubt that, our differences simply do not melt. They just do not die. That's just one qualm, then I would raise. And if that then is true, and then we want to move away from what, for example, Kwame Nkrumah calls the African elite, or the problem of elitism in terms of interpreting the African ethos becomes simply glares at us. Because what the elite have tried to do, and there are a lot of them in Africa, and what they have tried to do is simply to appropriate African symbols and reinterpret them within the general, major, theoretical thought pattern of the world. And they have not dared to be different. And those who dare to be different, such as Nyerere, for example, are tried by the elite. They are just ignored by the elite because they are dismissed as nothing but traditionalists. Mm-hmm. And I think that is unfortunate, because for me it represents a very sophisticated form of an elitism, or a very sophisticated form of secularism. What I am doing is that, in spite of having grown up in urban South Africa, having had both urban exposure as well as rural exposure, I still believe myself to be predominantly an African agrarian parent. I refuse to be anything. I don't want to call myself as an urban African, which is really, it appears to be very great for those of us who have been to school and have been to school as long as I have been. That is the only scapegoat, and therefore then you are going to become the African rationalist, the African Freudian, who interprets symbols within the motif of demystification. And I try to I think the African ethos is has enough integrity and authenticity in and of itself that we should know better than that, or do better than that.
I don't know if I can continue on that line, but I'd like to try because I find it fascinating. Nyerere's response to that is to build the modern nation from that African indigenous base. The emphasis then is on rural development, because that's where the roots are. But you in South Africa both are living in a modern industrial state and seeking to be the effective majority, and not simply in terms of power, and not only the numerical majority, which you already are. Then your theology, however, has somehow to come to terms with that industrial society. And the question is whether that is inherently a society which, if you accept the patterns of it, will not be destructive of your African peasant ethos, agrarian ethos. I mean, that's just an enormous...
Yeah.
We do not have the example of any modern state being a modern industrial state that has not destroyed the peasantry. There is not one.
Good question.
And so what kind of
good
theology
question.
Then, or what kind of perspective?
Perhaps that really, in a nutshell, is what has caused both Bishop Tutu and Manas Buthelezi to try to move away from what they call the worldview motif in appropriating such a symbol. And I agree that also there are no simplistic answers that I can give you in this. This is in the making for me, and really a serious problem, because the Russian experiment has failed us, because it has itself been bureaucratized into some kind of what I call quasi-capitalism. So that for those kinds of because of those kinds of serious constraints, what I'm coming up with is really problematic. But perhaps that's why I'm in graduate school. Because postgraduate school, because I really believe that, given the failure of the Eastern Bloc, so-called, and I mean by the Eastern Bloc, I include the Chinese experiment. So that, there are, we have a history of failure for what I am propounding, if this really is an exercise in futility, why? Why begin? Why waste time and think probably there is something that can come out of this to bridge the two? Maybe I'll make another contradiction again here, and I'm aware that it is a contradiction. I am very skeptical over the agrarian differences as epitomized in the Weberian enterprise.
In the what enterprise?
In Max Weber, distinction between, agrarian societies and so-called Western capitalism, for example, where the peasantry is completely discarded in the interest of capitalism and its force, of course, in the Protestant faith, as it enunciates in capitalism, and I forget the name of the book now, but you know that as well as I do. But I'm opposed to this because I feel the Weberian enterprise leaves us paralyzed And I think I am more interested in such endeavors as, for example, Roger Hansen's body argument in his book entitled Beyond the North-South Stalemate, in which he is moving us in the same way that Mark has been trying to in the whole of last week, of moving to alternative lifestyle, which then would comprise a new economic system which the United Nations is working rather vigorously on. And I happen to be fortunate to attend a Peace and Justice Conference at Oxford College in Minneapolis last spring, where authorities in these matters really presented fascinating paper. There is currently a big debate in moving towards what is called, quote unquote, alternative lifestyle. These alternative incentives are themselves, are interdisciplinary, so that they don't borrow from sociology per se or political science or the general Western academia or thought pattern which tends to categorize things rather rigidly. And all these say that, if we are to move front with these proposals of alternative lifestyles, then our world becomes the global community, the new global community, where it's going to be a give and take between the polarities as we see them today, rather than hopefully thinking, because I would really answer in the final analysis by saying that, capitalism has also failed us. And I'm not going to talk about capitalism in the third world per se, as Hansen does. I think capitalism, even in the so-called first world of the United States, has just not been able to deliver. And I stay in Berkeley, for example, and I just know that if you lived in the low-lying areas of Berkeley, of the city of Berkeley, perhaps one of the most progressive cities in the United States, you are a different person than the people that are up on the Piedmont or Berkeley Heights. This is a given. This is a contradiction that capitalism lives with. And therefore, for me, it shows that the capitalistic motive itself has not been a global answer. If we are to move to some kind of other goal, then we have to mitigate and fight what I think, and this is where I think the balance, the idea of balance amongst the Zulus, for example, helps us to do that kind of give and take.
Yeah. Just a comment, I find that very exciting because I think it's also clear that what you're talking about is at present incompatible with the ethos of industrial society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we're struggling with is somehow to move from industrialism, whether it's a socialist industrialism or a capitalist industrialism, to something which has a sense of equilibrium, balance, harmony, where you don't fragment and segment society, where you don't have a class systems of various kinds or whatever, to something which is more ecological in the social as well as an environmental sense. And at that point, it seems to me that your African resources may be enormously helpful, but in your situation, to do that in a modern industrial state is an enormous challenge. It may not be, I don't know, I just think that's an epochal undertaking. That's going from one chapter in human history to another chapter in human history, and not a kind of coming to terms with what is.
In other words, it's idealistic par excellence.
Well, I hope you meant that it's realizable as technology.
Yeah, I would like to end this comment by saying that, it's 10 to 12 and our time is running out, so I would like us to close here. But I want to just to make one remark as to the question, because I think, Larry, your question is well taken, and also is in fact a serious one. But besides the kinds of alternatives that have thrown to you, such as this the effort of the United Nations, for example, with the alternative economic system, as well as for the developed world or alternative lifestyle. I think within the third world, I did a paper, for example, for my com on ideology. And what I tried to do there was to compare the Zambian humanistic or Zambian humanism or Zambian socialism vis-a-vis what I call the laissez-faire capitalism as operative in the Republic of South Africa to date. I think there are instances where we can begin, even this is maybe but a drop in the bucket, there are indicators where people have tried to move away even with an industrialized economy and using then the copper base in Zambia. That's precisely what Kaunda has attempted to do. If failure really does not arise only from the failure in terms of Zambia or the failure in terms of using the dividend from the copper profit, but it has been more what I call economic dependency has been the phenomenon that has thwarted, that experiment, because the international multinational companies have simply skillfully ostracized Zambia. You know, they did not support Zambia to the same extent that they did, for example, the South African economy, for obvious reasons. So that the failure that has occurred has been a deliberate failure by the monopolies of the Western powers that they have in international forums, including the International Monetary Fund, so that they perpetuate this. So it's those kinds of constraints that if our lobbying within the United States, as well as also our lobbying from within the so-called quote-unquote developing world, we should be able to circumvent some of those. But whether or not we do have that muscle power at this point in time, I dare say that is in the making. Yes, Will, you had a question.
Well, I think you made the point. I think it's too early to preside over the death of Kaunda's notion or Nairi. They aren't done for yet. I'm surprised that the Tanzanian experiment has survived even the liberation of Uganda.
Yeah.
And we really need to take a look at the tremendous amount of resourcefulness and power that's been generated in Tanzania, even in the face of it all. Oh, it's true. I sat and I cry with Tanzanians too over all the buildings and those towns that are being delivered up to white ants. But so what? You know, that's being done in American cities every day. I believe that we have at least some glimpses of this possibility. If, for example, Kaunda, Mary, and other persons developing their things in places like Angola and Mozambique would have a chance to dicker on a market that's not dominated by you know who. and you know what? That I think that's a part of the problem. I don't think that there are any inherent deficiencies in the system, except as they have to extend themselves outside. Of course, no country has been quite able to move without doing that. It's a market that's still dominated either by the American version of capitalism or the Russian version of state capitalism.
I think on that positive note.